Chapter 18. The malachite green sea merged with the peridot green water flowing through the channel of the large lagoon that nestled between the volcanic lava cliffs of Raoul Island. Once inside the narrow channel, the lagoon widened into a small but respectable anchorage. Beyond was the tributary mouth of a stream that ran down the rugged slopes of Mount Mumukai and into the waters of the lagoon. The sandy, horseshoe-shaped beach was interspersed with sea-worn black lava rock and framed by a marching army of cocoa palms. From the sea, only a tiny section of the lagoon could be seen through the chasm whose cliffs rose on each side of the channel. It was like peering through a telescope into a distant, narrow slit. High atop the west side of the entrance, more than 300 feet above the surf crashing against the shore, a small shack built of palm fronds perched dangerously close to the edge. The native look was a facade. Beneath the palm fronds were walls built of concrete blocks. The interior was air-conditioned, and the windows were tinted. A security guard sat inside a comfortable little house, studying the vast expanse of ocean with a large pair of binoculars mounted on a stand for any sign of a ship. He sat in a soft executive chair before a computer, radio, and a VCR with a monitor. A chain smoker, he had heaped an ashtray with dead butts. Across from him, neatly stacked in a rack against one wall, were four missile launchers and two automatic rifles. With this arsenal, he could have held off a small navy trying to force its way into the lagoon. 30 years old, wiry, and in good physical shape, he stared almost vacantly at the brilliant sea as he rubbed a hand over the stubble of new beard growth. He was blonde and blue-eyed and a former Special Forces veteran, hired by the in-house security department of a vast corporate empire about which he knew little and cared even less. His assignments covered the world and occasionally included assassination, but he was paid, and paid well. That's all that mattered. He yawned and changed the discs in his CD player. His taste was eclectic and ran from classical to soft rock. He had just pushed the play button when his eye caught a movement around the outcropping of rock that fell off just beyond his security shack. He swung the binoculars and focused on a bright blue and white object that was coming very fast over the water. It was a yacht, the strangest-looking yacht he had ever seen, not a sailboat, but a twin-hulled catamaran power cruiser, and it was cutting through the sun-danced water at what he guessed as close to 40 knots. He rubbed his eyes and stared through the big, powerful binoculars again. The boat was a good 70 feet, he estimated. He couldn't decide if he loved her design or hated it. The more he examined her lines, the more elegant and exotic she appeared. She reminded him of a pair of ice skates cut down and molded together with a circular wheelhouse on the top. On the upper open deck, two people, a man and woman, lounged in a jacuzzi, drinking out of tall glasses and laughing. All the craft's windows were tinted, and he could not see any suggestion of other crew members or passengers. He turned to the radio, switched on the transmitter, and began speaking. "This is Pirate. I have a private yacht approaching from the northeast." "The northeast, you say?" replied a voice like sandpaper. "Probably on a cruise from Tahiti to New Zealand." "Any sign of weapons or armed personnel?"
"None."
"She doesn't look threatening," asked the rough voice.
"Not unless you consider two naked people in a jacuzzi threatening."
"Is she making toward the channel?"
The security guard examined the heading of the twin bows as the yacht sped closer.
"She looks to be going past."
"Stay on the air and report any suspicious movement if she turns into the channel. You know what you have to do."
The guard glanced at one of the missile launchers.
"A pity to destroy such a handsome boat."
He swung in his chair and gazed at the boat through the glasses again, somewhat pleased at seeing it continue on a course past the channel. He watched until it became a tiny speck in the distance. Then he called over the radio again.
"This is Pirate. The yacht is gone. It appears as if she dropped anchor in the open lagoon on the south end of Macaulay Island."
"Then she's harmless," said a rough voice.
It would seem so.
Watch her lights after dark and make sure she stays put.
I suspect she settled in for the night. Her passengers and crew are probably going to barbecue steaks on the beach. They just look like yachtsmen on a South Pacific cruise.
I'll fly a reconnaissance in the helicopter and see if you're right.
Misty and Giordino were not naked in the hot tub. They were wearing swimsuits provided by Cussler. They were, however, sipping rum Collins's as the boat cruised under the steep palisades of Raoul Island. Cussler and Pitt were not as lucky. The old man sat at the helm station with a chart in his lap, eyeing the depth sounder and examining the bottom coral reefs that could have sliced the Periwinkle's twin hulls like razor blades through cardboard. Pitt had the worst job of all. He lay sweating under a pile of pillows and towels on the lower lounge deck, videotaping the guardhouse at the top of the cliffs overlooking the channel entrance. Once the yacht was anchored, they all settled into the main salon and gazed at the monitor while Pitt played the tape on the VCR. The telephoto lens on the camera, combined with the video enhancement, revealed the guard through the windows of the guardhouse in slightly fuzzy detail, but clear enough to distinguish him peering at them through a pair of huge binoculars. Added to the video was the soundtrack of the conversation between the guard and the coarse voice of his colleague, somewhere in the Raoul Island Lagoon, as traced and recorded by Cussler's high-tech communication systems. "We fooled them," said Misty, unhesitating.
"Lucky we didn't attempt to run up the channel with all flags flying," Giordino said, pressing a bottle of cold beer against his forehead.
"They didn't give the impression they take kindly to strangers," Pitt agreed. As if to affirm his statement, the thump of rotors and roar of engine exhaust sounded throughout the cabin as a helicopter flew over the yacht.
"The man said he was going to reconnoiter us," said Pitt. "What say we go out and wave to them?"
A red and yellow painted helicopter, with its registration number and ownership lettering on its fuselage hidden under duct tape, hovered no more than 100 feet in the air and slightly off the stern of the Periwinkle. Two men wearing flowered shirts peered down at the yacht. Pitt lay sprawled on a couch on the lounge deck, while Giordino stood partially under the deck overhang, videotaping the aircraft with the camera hidden under his shirt and armpit. Misty and Cussler stood beside the jacuzzi and waved to the men above. Pitt held up a glass and motioned for the pilots to join them. Seeing a woman and an older man with gray hair and beard must have dismissed their suspicions. The pilot of the helicopter waved back and banked the aircraft around the yacht and headed back to Raoul Island, satisfied that the tourists were no menace. As soon as the craft was a speck in the blue sky, they all headed back into the saloon. Giordino pulled the videotape from the camera under his shirt and slid it into the VCR. The zoom focus clearly showed a sandy-haired man with a grizzled beard at the controls and a black man flying as co-pilot.
"Now we have faces to go with a plot," mused Giordino.
Cussler clicked off the remote.
"What happens now?"
"As soon as it's dark, we build a small raft and attach lights on it so it looks like a boat lit up from a distance. Then we sail back under cover of the cliffs near the channel just out of sight of the guard above the cliffs. The boat won't be detected because the video shows no indication of radar equipment. Then Al and I will go in the water and take a swim up the channel to the lagoon, a little fishing expedition to have a look around. If we're right and the deep encounter is hidden under camouflage netting, we sneak aboard, overpower the hijackers, free our friends, and sail off into the blue."
"That's the plan?" asked Giordino, his eyes squinting as if seeing a mirage in the desert.
"That's the plan," Pitt echoed. Misty looked dumbstruck. "You can't be serious. The two of you going up against 50 or more armed hijackers? That's the craziest scheme I've ever heard."
Pitt shrugged. "I admit I may have oversimplified things just a shade, but I really don't see any other way of handling the job."
"We could call up the Aussies and have them send a special force," suggested Cussler. "They can be here in 24 hours.
We may not have the time, said Pitt. If the hijackers haven't sunk the deep encounter and everybody on it by now, chances are they'll do it tonight after dark. 24 hours from now may be too late. It's madness to throw your lives away, Misty persisted. We have no choice, Pitt said firmly. Time is not on our side. What about weapons? Asked Giordino, as casually as if he were asking the price of an ice cream cone. I have a pair of automatic rifles I carry for protection, offered Cussler. But I can't say how well they and the ammo will perform after being dragged a mile underwater. Pitt shook his head. Thank you, but it's better we swim in unencumbered. As far as firepower, we'll worry about it when the time comes. What about dive equipment? I have 4 filled air tanks and 2 regulators. The less equipment, the better. Dive equipment would only hinder us once we came ashore. We'll snorkel into the lagoon. Nobody could spot us in the dark from 20 feet away. You'll have a long swim, said Cussler. From where I'll moor the boat, the inside of the lagoon is over a mile. We'll be lucky to get in by midnight, muttered Giordino. I can cut your time by 2 hours. Pitt looked at Cussler. How? I have a dive thruster that will pull you through the water. You can use it to propel you both in tandem. That will be a great help, thank you. Is there nothing I can say to talk you out of this senselessness? Misty pleaded. No, said Pitt. His lips spread slightly in a comforting smile. This thing has to be done. There wouldn't be a security facility at the entrance to the channel if there wasn't something inside someone wanted to hide. We have to find out if it's the deep encounter. And if you're wrong? The smile was gone suddenly, and Pitt's face became tense. If we're wrong, then our friends on board the ship will die because we failed to save them. Beginning just after sunset, it took the 3 men 2 hours to tie several palm tree trunks together into a raft and then construct a rough outline of the Periwinkle with framing scrounged from driftwood. For a finishing touch, a small battery was connected to a string of lights on the framework. Then the raft was anchored on the shore side of the yacht. Not a bad facsimile, if I do say so, Cussler assented. It ain't pretty, said Giordino, but it should fool the security guards sitting in his little hovel 5 miles away. Pitt splashed seawater on his face to wash away the sweat brought on by the humidity. We'll turn on the lights of the raft at the same moment we turn off the lights of the yacht. Within minutes, Cussler engaged the Periwinkle's big engines and eased the yacht forward as he pressed the switch to the winch that raised the anchor. Then he shifted the lights to the raft and threw the yacht into darkness. He ran the yacht out past the reef, keeping an eye on the depth sounder, gauging the depth of the coral that lurked below the surface like malicious killer teeth, waiting to send the yacht sinking into the depths beyond. He steered toward Raoul Island by radar, watching carefully to see if the boat was stirring up any phosphorescence in her wake. He kept the speed down to 10 knots and was thankful that the star-carpeted sky held no moon. Pitt joined him at the helm station with Misty, who had resigned herself to the operation and had prepared snacks in the galley. She passed them around and sat next to Al, who was wearing headphones, trying to mimic the gravelly voice recorded during the security guard's conversation. Cussler laid out the chart showing the water depths around the island and aimed the twin bows toward the tiny light high on the cliffs that came from the security guard's little house. I'll bring us inside the outcropping of rocks just in front of the channel, he explained. From there, you'll have to rely on the thruster. Keep well clear of the surf, pounding on the cliffs until you reach calm water. For the first time, Cussler was showing something approaching trepidation. He rarely threw a glimpse out the window into the pitch-black night. He reserved his attention for an occasional glance at the compass. He steered the yacht almost exclusively by depth sounder and radar, seated extravagantly, his hands resting on the joystick and computer trackball. He slid open a window and heard the unmistakable sound of surf crashing against solid rock. Pitt could hear it too. They were behind the rock outcropping and out of the security guard's line of sight. The water beyond the surf line was incredibly calm. Cussler pressed a button on the joystick that was the throttle and decreased the speed to a slow crawl. Finally satisfied that he was as near to the rocks as he dared go, he set the engines in neutral and turned to Pitt, the expression in his eyes saying, "This is not a good idea," but voicing nothing. Studying the craggy bottom only 15 feet below the Periwinkle's twin hulls on the depth sounder, and staring thoughtfully at his drift readings, he let go the anchor. As soon as the boat was safely moored with her bows dipping into the incoming tide, he nodded. "This is as far as I go." "How long can you stay?" asked Pitt. "I'd like to say until you return, but the tide turns in another 3 hours and 20 minutes. Then I'll have to move farther off the shore, or risk losing the boat, and steer back around the island to stay out of the guard's view." "How will we find you in the dark?" "I have an underwater radio transmitter I use to study fish reactions to different sounds. In 2 hours, I'll begin playing a Meatloaf recording." Misty looked at him. "You listen to Meatloaf?" Cussler laughed. "Can't an old rooster like rock?" "Does he attract sharks?" asked Giordino warily. Cussler shook his head. "They prefer Tony Bennett." Pitt and Giordino pulled on borrowed fins and masks. Cussler lowered the stern ladder and stood back. He patted both of them on the shoulder. "Remember, stay clear of the rocks at the entrance of the channel and then wait for the swells to carry you inside. No sense draining the thruster's batteries unnecessarily." Then he paused, almost solemnly. "Good luck. I'll wait as long as I can." They dropped into the warm, ink-black water with only a slight splash and swam a short distance from the boat, Giordino following in Pitt's wake. Pitt guessed the water temperature at close to 80 degrees. There was a slight offshore breeze and a mild chop came with the incoming tide. After stroking for several minutes, they paused and looked back. Once past 100 feet, the Periwinkle became invisible. Pitt held up his wrist and studied the luminescent needle and degree markings on the compass lent to him by the old man. He tapped Giordino on the head and motioned into the distance. Giordino wrapped his arms around Pitt's legs and hung on as the thruster was switched on. The motor hummed and the jets began pulling them through the water at nearly 3 knots. Pitt could only navigate by the little compass and by the sound of the surf that beat against the rock cliffs with a low, sullen boom. The menacing rocks could have been 100 yards away or 200. There was no way of telling in the darkness. Then his ears distinguished 2 separate booms, suggesting that the waves were striking on opposite sides of the channel. He twisted the thruster and let it pull them toward the island until the surf was heard thundering on his right and left, but not ahead. Then, as instructed by Cussler, he switched off the thruster and allowed the waves to carry them through the channel entrance. It was sound advice. There were no giant plunging breakers between the steep walls of the channel. Because of the deeper water in mid-channel and with no obstructions, the surf here merely rolled forward without building and curling under, sweeping them safely through the rocks as if they were corks. Pitt floated face down, legs outspread, as relaxed as a turtle sleeping on the surface. His breathing was slow and steady through the snorkel. Thanks to the thruster, they were nowhere near the point of exhaustion. Giordino had released his grasp momentarily and was drifting alongside Pitt. Neither man rolled over and looked up to see if they had been spotted. They didn't have to bother. If they couldn't see a guard standing on the edge of the cliff, no guard could have seen them in the darkened waters far below. Belatedly, Pitt began to wonder if the hijackers had posted guards around the lagoon. He doubted they would be that security conscious. It was next to impossible to scale the cliffs surrounding the island in the dark and then penetrate the thick jungle while hiking over jagged lava rock. He felt certain the only pair of eyes watching for intruders was that of the guard over the channel entrance. From the brief glimpse he'd had of the lagoon through the channel hours earlier when the Periwinkle had passed the entrance,
He estimated that it stretched in a straight line approximately a third of a mile from the sea. Feeling the impetus of the waves slacken until they were little more than 2 feet high, he alerted Giordino to hang on as he engaged the thruster again. In less than 15 minutes, the stars above opened and spread across the sky as they passed under the high cliffs into the open lagoon. Pitt angled the thruster off to the side of the beach and kept the power on until he could feel sand beneath his feet. Only then did he shut it down. There was no indication of inhabited structures on the beach, but the lagoon was far from deserted. Two vessels lay moored side by side in the middle of the lagoon. Their shapes and outlines were indistinguishable in the dark. As Pitt suspected, they were made even more formless by camouflage netting that was draped over both ships. But for a few dim lights emitting from their ports, they were unrecognizable. Without a closer look, it was impossible to identify the deep encounter in the black night. "Take off your face mask," Pitt whispered to Giordino. "The lights might reflect off our lenses." Leaving the thruster on the beach, they swam toward the larger of the two ships. She was anchored, with her bow facing into the channel. The vessel had a graceful, raked bow, the same as the research vessel, but they had to be positive. Without the slightest hesitation, Pitt pulled off his fins, handed them to Giordino, and began climbing the anchor chain. It was damp, but reasonably free of rust and slime. He pulled himself up until he was even with the hawse pipe and hung there for a full minute. From the light from an open port, he could just barely make out the name on the welded letters on the bow. They read, "Deep Encounter."